Good afternoon. I'm Ward Atterbury. I'm an M&A partner at White & Case, and I guess I'm here to introduce my partner, Owen Pell, who graduated from this august institution sometime before me, rendering him ancient and knowledgeable, or at least ancient.
It was really nice here in the 1600s. It really was. Great.
Or in 1983, as the case may be. But he's a litigation partner at White & Case. Owen specializes in complex litigation. Just as an example of what he's doing. He currently is representing Deutsche Bank in the Enron litigation, which is going on down in Texas these days. Not the criminal variety, or he wouldn't be here, but the civil case. He has a substantial sovereign representation practice, including both Poland and Azerbaijan at the moment. He picks his clients well.
Longer names are better.
In the human rights area, Owen has represented various French and U.S. banks as well as various multinational corporations in the Holocaust cases. He's represented Citigroup in the apartheid reparations cases, J.P. Morgan Chase in the slavery representation cases. You get the drift in the nature of his practice these days. He also came up and formulated a proposed framework for dealing with looted art in the EU. It was the first framework for looted art, or the laws dealing with looted art in the EU, to gain any traction at all in the European Parliament, where it was approved by a 497-10 vote, proving you can't win them all. I think you have to lose the neo-Nazi
vote. I lost the neo-Nazi vote. It was Holocaust looted art and the neo-Nazis we voted for. Just can't please some of the people any of the time.
But this was the first looted art framework to sort of gain any traction in the European Parliament and be referred to the Commission, where it's currently under consideration. With that, I will give you Owen, who will talk to you about the new diplomacy.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ward. I don't even have to pay him to do that, which is really nice. I don't know that I would pay him to do that.
It's just part of the draw.
What I wanted to talk about today was something that we have noticed in our practice. In the firm over the last few years. It's something that we sort of saw happening, and I spoke to a number of my partners about it, and we actually think that it's an emerging process. I've called it the new diplomacy, as the idea is that we think that a process is emerging that will change the way international law may be formed and would also change the shape of that law as it develops. And let me just start by setting the scene, at least as we see it as practitioners. Let's think about the ingredients that we have in terms of international law. Traditionally, international law is very, very limited. You'll excuse me for that, but it just is. It's very limited. It generally has governed the relations and obligations among states. Over time, since World War II, it certainly has expanded to include certain relationships between states and people. But what hasn't changed, especially from the private practitioner's view, is that international law is difficult to define, and its formation generally is characterized by three things. It's remarkably uncertain, it's really difficult to get something to be international law, and it's remarkably tedious. And I think that those three characteristics, I mean, if you think about it, limiting and propagating norms is very difficult. If you look at the Restatement Third of Foreign Relations Law, Section 102 or 103, and they talk about the sources of international law, and they talk about things like custom, and you think about what custom means, right, general and consistent practice of states, acceptance by states of certain principles as binding and obligatory, you see that the sources of international law and the sources of that kind of custom are going to be very narrow, very limited, and are going to take an unbelievably long time to be formed. In terms of tedious, I mean, think about many famous doctrines in international law and how many decades or centuries they've taken to become truly accepted. And there are many reasons why that should be the case, right? Because states routinely have reasons, political and otherwise, for not wanting to accept a norm or not wanting to see something become a norm. And so even when we think about international agreements, which is another way for things to become customary or things to become international law, you look at how difficult it is to get states to even reach agreement, and look at how difficult it then becomes to get everyone to ratify the agreement that's been put out there as the exemplar. And if there is ratification, you always end up with the issue of reservations, you know, are states going to really buy into an entire treaty, or are they going to accept out certain portions of a treaty? And, in fact, when I was doing my Holocaust-looted artwork, one of the things that I was trying to figure out was, could you create a remedy for Holocaust-looted art to be claimed and or cleared without the need to negotiate a treaty? Because my thought was that if you needed a treaty, I would be dead and my son would already be done working and probably be retired before you'd ever see any progress. And so it was that fear of just decades going by that really drove me to try to figure out a remedial structure that didn't involve anything new, but instead could involve maybe something legislation like in the European Union that would take advantage of existing treaties. Because international law is so hard to form and so difficult to gain consensus for. So if we think about where we were in the early to mid-20th century, we think about how limited international law was. Very few recognized what I would call causes of action, that is, well-developed claims for remedies under international law. I mean, think about what we know as the common ones. Piracy, that was an easy one, right? Because you have the universal criminal, the person who roams the high seas, not a citizen of any state, preying on shipping. Perhaps embargo during war, the rights of diplomats and rights of passage, rights of combatants or neutrals during war. This tended to be where we were, certainly at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century. And as I said before, it was all about states. States were the motivators. States had to provide the impetus. Post-World War II and heading into the Cold War, we did see an explosion of UN-generated conventions, especially as to human rights. But think about what the problems were. Same problems stayed in place. The conventions, especially as to human rights, were often aspirational, not necessarily well-defined or accepted in practice. If you look at, for example, the Second Circuit decision in Flores versus Southern Peru Copper, or the Second Circuit decision in the United States versus Youssef, or Dreyfus versus Von Finck, or even the Supreme Court's recent decision in Sosa, you see that the courts have been very skeptical about the lack of detail and the lack of precision in most human rights conventions. The conventions have routinely been limited by the absence of ratification or by reservations by states. For example, if you look at the United States, we routinely have a reservation that goes in, I think, to almost every human rights treaty we've ever done on federalism. The federalism reservation, which I know, I mean, what is it, 70 inmates on death row now in U.S. prisons who are probably there in violation of the Vienna Convention. And there's a reservation when the Senate ratified that goes to that, that we just don't see ourselves bound in certain ways to the extent it relates to federalism. So there are very thorny issues. There has consistently been a lack of remedies at either the state or the international level. I guess what you could say the good news was in the explosion of human rights conventions in the UN system, one was that we certainly for the first time paid more attention to issues. Both environmental and human rights issues started getting a lot more attention under the UN system. We certainly now have more information being collected than we used to see being collected, and that's a good thing because that helps. You could make an argument, I suppose, that that eventually will help consensus forming by at least providing information that didn't used to be there. And it certainly has encouraged a lot of NGOs and IGOs. It's given them something to focus on. It's given people a lot to debate and talk about. But where we were as of the end of the Cold War was that system, where states had to really provide the impetus. It's a very cumbersome system, and it takes a long time to get anywhere. Now let's think about multinationals, multinational corporations. They've been around at least since the 1600s. The Hudson Bay companies, right, the British East India companies, British West India companies, they generally followed the development of colonial empires. By the early 20th century, certainly were well established in places like the Netherlands, Germany, England, France, Belgium, and the United States. I guess when they were in the colonial empires, maybe you could argue they weren't truly foreign in terms of their non-indigenous operations, their non-home operations. But what were MNCs always dealing with? Right? MNCs were always about taking advantage of differing and competing legal systems. Right, doing things someplace else that you couldn't do at home, or maybe you couldn't do exactly the same way at home, or figuring out ways to move your money or profits around to take advantage of differences and thereby increase those profits or pay less taxes, etc. MNCs have always been closely aligned, traditionally, with state policy, probably having to do especially with the colonial mandates, including, historically, human rights violations. Right? We know that, and there's a lot of history about that. Just in terms of late 19th century, early 20th century, we can look at the Belgian Congo and the role of key Belgian mining companies. We can look at Angola, where the German steamship lines were really helped set up some of the first concentration camps in Africa to get control of the Herero tribe in Angola and drive them away from the coast so that the settlers could come in. Certainly the operation of certain big French companies in French West Africa, U.S. mining companies down in Latin America, and some of the things they did all the way into the 70s. So we have a historical tendency among multinationals to seek areas of less regulation, areas of less transparency, areas where they are willing to become perhaps agents of state policy, even if it means being involved in human rights violations, to the extent it helps their business interests. But the focus I would propose is that they generally take advantage of comparative inconsistencies among states. That's what multinationals have always been really good at, especially, as we'll get to soon, before the WTO, before tax treaties became more prevalent. It was really a lot about transfer pricing, moving profits around, moving costs around, and taking advantage of the differences among states in terms of how things were regulated. Now let's look at NGOs and IGOs. Pre-20th century, I have trouble thinking of any real NGOs other than maybe the Red Cross. I'd be interested to know whether you think of it. But the Red Cross struck me as one of the ones that did exist pre-20th century. Pre-World War II, post-World War I, maybe there were some more, especially those arising out of some of the League of Nations organs, but not many. After World War II, we see a lot of NGOs and IGOs finally forming. But in the UN system, because we were in the Cold War, they were very hamstrung, right? I mean, a lot of you, I'm sure, have done reading on this, how it was not unusual in terms of IGOs, certainly, that were UN-associated. If anything opened up in terms of a leadership position, there were always these politics between the US and the USSR about who could be appointed, whether they could do their jobs, whether IGOs could do everything that was on their agenda, was always very controversial, again, because of Cold War politics and balance of power politics. So it was a very polarized process. And I think it arguably made it very hard for IGOs and associated NGOs to really get things off the ground. I think a lot of that started to change at the end of the Cold War. I mean, post-1991 is what I'd like to sort of focus on. And I think there's an argument that with the end of the Cold War, certain forces were unleashed that were probably always there before, but had perhaps been stymied by the Cold War and by the polarization that occurred during the Cold War. I think the force that was unleashed in particular, that I've at least noticed in a lot of legal regulation, is the idea of individual recognition. That is, all of a sudden, there's a lot of pressure to change legal rules in the way the law interacts with people. Let's just develop that for a second. I think there's a significant argument, certainly from my perspective as a business lawyer, that we have entered an age of accountability. And I'm going to flesh that out as to what I mean by accountability, but broadly speaking, there's a pressure at national and international levels to alter the rule of law to make institutions, including companies, more responsible and more responsive to the people with whom they interact. And that because of that, MNCs and NGOs are changing their behaviors in terms of how they interact and how they interact with states. Just as a tangent, some of this, to me, is explained by Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History and the Last Man, which is a great book. I recommend it to everyone. I think it's a very interesting book. But Fukuyama's argument is that economic interpretations of history are sort of incomplete, and they don't explain fully a lot of the developments that occurred. And his argument is that the true engine of history is the idea of individuals searching for recognition. And I would suggest that when you think about recognition, I mean, Fukuyama talks about rising educational levels lead to people demanding more human rights, but I think there's a very good argument that the rule of law, the development of rule of law, and how rules of law develop in societies as societies develop, follows a very similar pattern. That is, I think we're seeing now in a lot of places around the world, as political systems get more similar, you're seeing more pressure to change rules of law to make for greater accountability within societies, whether it's government to people, whether it's companies to people, whether it's companies to governments. I think we're seeing pressure in that way. And in terms of accountability, again, what I'm focusing on is how law shapes rights and obligations and relationships among citizens, the government, and private institutions. And that's what I'm really talking about accountability, and I'm about to give concrete examples. I think we've probably seen examples of this before in the law. I'm not going to talk about them today, but I think I would suggest to you, for example, if you look at the development of equity in Old England, when the great writs were too rigid and too formalistic, and we see the development of the Chancery Court, I think that's an interesting example of the law, the rule of law having to develop to make itself more responsive to a developing society. But with the end of the Cold War, and I think as accelerated post 9/11, I think we see that a series of changes has occurred to the actors I described before, states, NGOs, IGOs, and multinationals. Let's look at the state level. Trade barriers have been plummeting, right? As the World Trade Organization regime becomes more the rule, trade barriers have been falling. Limits on cross-border investment and money movement have been decreasing. It's easier to do things that just when I came out of law school were very hard. Tax treaties are becoming more prevalent, so that those inconsistencies that existed are now becoming less prevalent. We now have things called bilateral investment treaties, which have replaced, in some respect, the regime of friendship, commerce, and navigation treaties that the U.S. and other countries used to use that address things like expropriation issues. And now we see more and more countries adopting a much more uniform approach to bilateral investment treaties and throwing any form of dispute relating to expropriation into ICSID in Washington, D.C., the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes. We see that rules of corruption have suddenly become universal. Right? Back in the 70s, it was all about the U.S. with the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, and everyone saying that, gee, that's a silly thing. Of course you have to have corruption. You can't do business without corruption in certain parts of the world. Now all of a sudden you have a U.N. Convention on Corruption that is broadly ratified, that in fact the EU has legislated into existence for all countries in the EU. You have the OECD rules on anti-money laundering. So now there's a huge focus on money laundering issues among banks and corporations. You have broad anti-terrorism legislation in the US, the EU, and through the OECD and the UN. You have issues of corporate fiduciary duties and transparency being legislated in the United States under the Sarbanes-Oxley law. You have EU rules that are beginning to converge in the same directions. Securities regulation among major markets is becoming more regularized. There are obviously still differences, but the differences are shrinking. Transparency is more the rule. People are moving more toward U.S. systems in terms of transparency and accountability. And so, you know, where does that lead you? Well, where you are now is that standards are converging. For example, when I graduated law school, you actually could have a secret Swiss bank account. We all used to dream about having secret Swiss bank accounts. You could go to the Cayman Islands and take advantage of bank secrecy. Now, the number of real secrecy havens is much smaller. There are probably only two or three left, and countries like the U.S. through the OECD are putting a lot of pressure on them to put them out of that business. They're not accepted anymore, in part because of 9/11. There is a view now that money laundering and bank secrecy tie in somehow to crime and terrorism, and there's less patience for it. Look at the pressures that were put on Israel, for example, by the United States after many years with regard to securities regulation and bank secrecy and getting financial records out of Israel, for example, to support criminal investigations here in the United States for things like tax evasion and securities fraud. So we're seeing a lot more of that now. MNCs must now be more accountable. in terms of how they move money, in terms of their financial structures, and they must be more transparent. And not to suggest that that multinationals are becoming altruistic, because I don't think that most of them are, but they're certainly pragmatic. They certainly, if anything, are pragmatic. And what they do see is they see a greater value in now avoiding conflicting legal rules. If they're going to be forced to be transparent, to be more transparent, what we now see multinationals saying is, okay, I now want consistent standards across jurisdictions so that it's less likely that I get smacked in one place for something that would work someplace else. And so they actually are now willing to see multiple legal regimes as long as they're just more and more consistent. Look at the NGO, now look at NGOs and IGOs. Increasingly, IGOs are coordinating on commercial and trade issues. Again, I think anti-terrorism, anti-money laundering, and securities regulation are three areas we really see. It's astounding the amount of work that's been done on anti-money laundering since 9/11. Talk to any compliance officer within a major U.S. banking institution, and you'll find that they now have executive positions that never existed before. And those are that every single money center bank in the United States now, by Fed regulation, must have a global anti-money laundering officer to whom the Fed can speak. And it is now a new section on when the bank examiners come in every 2 years from the Fed, they now have a whole new auditing section on anti-money laundering. And look at the penalties that have been handed down in the past couple of years on anti-money laundering are astounding. Even for banks that have not had a violation yet, this is for record-keeping problems, not an out-and-out money laundering problem, you're seeing routinely eight-figure settlements where banks are paying $10 to $20 million because they just didn't have proper procedures in place, even though no one had yet taken advantage of that lack of procedure. So we're seeing IGOs becoming much more aggressive. We've seen a rapid growth of NGOs, and we've seen an explosion of NGOs since the end of the Cold War. Maybe you could make an argument that in part has to do with, you know, the history of UN IGOs not being perhaps as effective. Maybe it has to do with budget issues at the UN. But I think there's really been an NGO explosion. I think there's an argument that NGOs are more maneuverable than IGOs. That maybe they're like multinationals that way. You know, they don't have to be as responsible to as many constituencies. I think a lot of NGOs have also matured in terms of the way they raise money and the way they manage themselves. I think the level of professionalism, you could argue, certainly in the last 10 or 15 years, I would say, has gone up. And I think in a post-Cold War system, they're much more relevant. And I think that's helped them. At the multinational level, as we've talked about, inconsistencies are under attack. So transparency is being demanded, legal structures are being tightened, and the penalties for not being accountable are rising. And again, Foreign Corrupt Practice Act and all the analogs to it outside the United States, anti-money laundering and all the analogs, Sarbanes-Oxley and its spreading analogs, and tax treaties and tax evasion. One way to think about it, and for those of you who are beer connoisseurs, this will look like the old Ballantine beer ad, but I apologize for that. You could argue that these are sort of the pressures toward greater accountability that we're seeing. And then if you look at states and multinationals and IGOs and NGOs, what's happening is they're arguably being pressed together. And right in here, I would argue, is sort of where the new diplomacy is. Because convergence is happening. They're being pressed together to be more accountable to one another and to have more interrelationships. And what you're beginning to see is a recognition that there is an efficiency to be gained by coordination. And that's really what a number of my partners and I have come to call the new diplomacy. So to state it concretely, rather than waiting for states to address among themselves a problem, NGOs and MNCs are in fact engaging with each other, where they used to be sworn enemies, wouldn't be seen in the same room together, let alone at the same conference or convention. They will now engage with each other and then work together toward a potential solution and then impose that solution or attempt to impose that solution on IGOs and states, sort of turning the whole system upside down. So rather than a top-down system, much more bottom-up, arguably much more microeconomic as opposed to macroeconomic. And the areas that are involved are those that have typically been viewed, I think, as non-binding, areas where the principles were more hortatory. Maybe international conventions are out there. Maybe academics have written that there should that there's something emerging that might become customary, but are typically not areas where we see binding state practice or rigorously developed legal rules. Due to economic and political self-interest of states, they typically have been areas where it's been very hard to argue that there's been a consensus. States have typically stayed away from these areas for their own political interest. Can't get them near it, can't even get superpowers to engage on these issues, let alone the states involved. I think that, and I think the other reason we've seen NGOs and MNCs go into these areas is that they obviously are not necessarily answering to the same agendas as states. They are independent actors in the system. I have a few examples that I can cite for this that I would say sort of define the new diplomacy. It's definitely something that you would argue is in its infancy, but I think it's hard to say there isn't a trend. One thing I would offer that you look for in each of these things that's very interesting, I would propose that each of the areas I'm about to talk about involve a large market share, the ability to concentrate MNCs and NGOs who represent, especially the MNCs, who represent real market share. And that's what I think creates the critical mass. The first one to talk about that is very interesting is the Cocoa Harvesting Labor Accord. If you go to Tom Harkin's website, he has used to have all the documents on the website. The Cocoa Harvesting Accord attempts to address an old problem. It's a problem that has been around for decades, and that is the issue of child labor being used in the harvesting of cocoa in West Africa, where most of the cocoa is coming from or has traditionally come from. What you had happen was a group of NGOs who were unhappy with the ability of the International Labor Organization to get anything off the ground went to a group of companies, and eventually it expanded to be the group of companies who represent 99% of the buyers of cocoa. So we're dealing with food companies like Nestle, Kraft. You're dealing with cosmetics companies like Estee Lauder, L'Oreal. You're dealing with all those companies put together and all their divisions, 99%. And basically, you had a cartel that was formed to negotiate with the NGOs. And when I say cartel, I really do mean it because, believe it or not, they got Justice Department clearance to talk to each other because otherwise it might have been an antitrust violation. And they got EU clearance the same way. They had to get antitrust clearance to have the negotiations. But the NGOs sat down with the multinationals, and the argument was, it is not in your interest to be using child labor. We, the NGOs, suggest that the only reason you do it is the issue of comparative cost. That you don't want, none of you want to break ranks and not use child labor picked cocoa because you're afraid you'll end up paying more and that you'll thereby cut your profits. But all of you MNCs should be neutral, assuming everyone were on the same playing field. You shouldn't care. Maybe you do care because you're moral, or maybe you do care because you have a conscience, but at a minimum, you should be neutral. And so what ultimately came out of the negotiations was an agreement. And the nature of the agreement is the MNCs put up money, I think it was $10 million, to the NGOs. They chose NGOs who would go into certain areas where 99% of the cocoa comes from and would do surveys. And they would survey the local labor markets. And the thesis was to try to identify those growing areas in West Africa, literally on a county-by-county basis, province-by-province basis, where child labor was prevalent, medium, not prevalent. But they basically came up with a system. The thesis then was that once they had a system in place, they would set up a certification system, again, monitored by the NGOs, paid for by the multinationals. And the theory was that the multinationals agreed that they would only buy their cocoa if it was certified as coming from areas where child labor was not used or was not very prevalent. They came up with that framework. They then went to the ILO, they then go to a state-run organization, and they went to the countries in West Africa that were principally affected, and they basically imposed it. They said, look, we want to do this. We're prepared to fund it. We think it's ultimately beneficial, and we want to do it. And the company said, we want to conduct business in this way. And eventually they got 20-something states to sign on to it. And these were all states that had generally fought any efforts at zeroing in on child labor before. Why? Because before, it was generally the NGOs focusing on just one state at a time. And nobody likes being singled out. And so you get massive state resistance and, you know, you get no traction. So the labor, as I understand it right now, from what I read, they are now in the survey phase. But the multinationals have pledged to put up upwards of $50 million to set up this system and are perfectly content to abide by it, knowing that once it gets going, these NGOs will no longer be attacking them for using child labor. And they'll be happy about that, and they've begun to actually see a commercial benefit in it. Another example is the Kimberley Accord on mercenary diamonds that was, I guess, finally negotiated by J.D. Bindenagel, who had been the Holocaust Affairs head at the State Department after Stu Eisenstadt before he left the government. The Kimberley Accord is sort of like the Cocoa Accord. They went to the people, like De Beers, who control the flow of diamonds out of Africa, in large part. And they went to the people who buy those diamonds. So end users in the consumer industry and end users in the industrial industry. So Halliburton, for example. Companies that do drill bits, for example, or use diamonds for abrasives. They got the buy side and the supply and the sell side together, in effect, and they tried to clamp down on the idea of mercenary diamonds. Mercenary diamonds are diamonds that flow out of areas of civil war in Africa, where the thesis is that young children who are swept up into these mercenary armies are being used at no pay to harvest these diamonds, get them out onto the world market, where they're then used to buy arms that perpetuate these ethnic and civil wars. The Mercenary Diamond Accord is, again, similar. It's designed to shut off the flow of diamonds from certain areas and also will involve, ultimately, the imprinting on diamonds of a barcode, of a microscopic barcode that will be scannable in many cases to, again, certify where things are coming from. Another one that's of particular interest to us in our practice, I don't think Ward runs into it because it really doesn't impact M&A, but certainly our project finance guys do, are the Equator Principles. There's been a lot written about the Equator Principles. The Equator Principles came about through the auspices of the World Bank. The World Bank went around to a group of financial institutions that represent, they thought, 80%, I think today you would argue closer to 90%, of the banks that engage in project financing. And by project financing, we're talking about the private financing of large infrastructure projects. So we're talking toll roads, other kinds of highways, power plants, dams, ports, airports, etc. You can't have project financing without private banks. You're talking billions and billions of dollars of private financing to organize these deals. What the Equator Principles recognize is that many times in developing countries, these large projects have terrific effects that are detrimental to the local economy, whether we're talking human rights issues in terms of the clearing of villages, the forced relocation of indigenous peoples, environmental problems, the destruction of cultural property and cultural heritage property covered by various UN conventions, I guess with regard to oil pipelines in places like Myanmar, massive human rights violations of local populations who were impressed into service on these projects, sometimes against their will. If you look at the Three Gorges Dam in China, the issues were many environmental issues that arose on those projects. The Equator Principles basically say that for projects, I think it's, yeah, for any project bigger than $50 million, the World Bank has now set up standards where the lenders are pledging to set up internal corporate codes of conduct for lending. And the lenders are agreeing that they will not lend into projects if those projects are going to violate certain UN conventions. And what is most terrifying for lenders, and very interesting for litigators like me, the lenders are agreeing for the first time to actually collect on an ongoing basis non-financial data. So the lenders have said, we will monitor compliance. Now, generally, lenders don't like to do that, right? Typically, you lend money and you take the position, if the person to whom I'm lending the money misuses the money, that's not my problem. Okay, even at Nuremberg, that worked. Right, at Nuremberg, Dresdner Bank was accused of lending money to the SS, knowing that it was going to be used to build concentration camps where atrocities would occur. They were acquitted of aiding and abetting genocide on that particular charge. And a panel at Nuremberg, actually a panel of three U.S. judges, wrote a decision that said, when a bank lends money, it does not become an agent in the wrongs committed with that money. You could argue the same reasoning was applied at Nuremberg when they let Krupp off for selling weapons to the German army. Same idea, right? It's not illegal to sell guns to an army. If the army then uses the guns to commit mass atrocities, well, okay, but that's not Krupp's fault. Now you've got the Equator Principles, and the lenders are saying, we will self-report. We will actually monitor these projects. We will collect data on 50 different UN conventions and what's going on the projects as they are implemented. And we will report back to the World Bank. And if we see violations, we will talk to the World Bank about whether we should shut down the projects, whether we should shut off the money. For example, I think last week there was an announcement that a big project in Chad has now been shut down because of violations of the UN Convention on Corruption. That it became very clear to the banks involved that money was being siphoned off, and so the banks have shut down the money under the auspices of the World Bank, saying shut off the money. And what's interesting is the banks are now beginning to put provisions in their lending documents that give them the right to shut off the money and that force the countries perhaps to go to arbitration over whether violations have occurred if the countries dispute whether the violations have occurred. It's very, very interesting. And, I mean, for example, all the, I guess it's Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, most of the large U.S. money center banks are in it. Most, believe it or not, most of the big French banks are in it, which I always found surprising. The three largest banks in Germany are in it. And I think overall there are now at least 50 banks representing easily 80 to 90% of the project finance market that are involved in it. There was another project, something similar to that, called, oddly enough, the Dam Commission. I suppose you could change that to be the Dam Commission, but the Dam Commission principles, where a group of NGOs attempted to get together with large engineering firms. So the theory was that Greenpeace was actually going to sit down at a table with Bechtel, for example, which is sort of funny to even think about. They were going to sit down at a table together. They were going to bring in academics, people who are specializing in the building of dams, the largest dam projects you can imagine. And the question was, could they agree on a set of principles under which you would sometimes say, when an engineering company would sometimes say, we're not going to build that dam. We don't need to build that dam, which is sort of antithetical in the world of project development. Interestingly, they did agree on a set of principles, which surprised everyone. The academic who was chosen to run the project, put out a report that people felt actually included principles that everyone hadn't agreed with, so there was a lot of consternation over that. And the biggest problem is they had no lenders at the table. And interestingly, that's gone nowhere. And I would argue it's because they didn't bring the lenders in. They didn't have the market share numbers right. They had the engineering firms, but they didn't have the money at the table that drives the process. Another thing we see happening that's very interesting is the increased use of corporate codes of conduct and self-monitoring. Best example of that we've seen, again, examples of MNCs working with NGOs, is what British Petroleum did in Aceh province. British Petroleum just won a huge... Just about 5 years ago, won a very large concession in Aceh province. Actually, more than 5 years ago now, about like 6 or 7. They won a huge concession in Aceh province. They typically have not been in the third world. British Petroleum, for a long time, certainly through the 80s, was more about North Sea oil. They didn't have to violate human rights to get oil out of from under the North Sea. They now have won this big concession in Aceh province. Obviously, a number of oil companies have had terrible trouble in Aceh province with human rights violations, especially to the extent they use the Indonesian army to provide quote-unquote security for their operations. And the army then tends to come in and tends to wipe out villages in a rather helter-skelter fashion. What BP said is, BP said, well, we don't want to be associated with human rights violations. We're not going to do that. So they set up an internal committee that would report directly to the board of directors. And they asked George Mitchell and I think five other luminaries to be on the committee. They gave the committee funding, almost like their audit committee. They gave the committee funding, they allowed the committee to hire lawyers and accountants, and they told the committee, your job is to hire the people we need to monitor whether there are human rights violations occurring on the ground where our concession is, and report to the board. And if the board isn't happy with what it hears, we're going to shut the project down. So they literally said, we're going to set up a self-reporting mechanism, and we're going to take information in which, open paren, could lead to lawsuits against them, close paren. That's what's really interesting, Some of you may know the Doe versus Unocal cases out in the Ninth Circuit, right, in terms of the oil pipeline in Myanmar and Unocal's association with the use of local security forces to provide security for the project and the human rights violations that then ensued. That was a place where one of the reasons the lower court felt they couldn't grant summary judgment for Unocal was that Unocal had information relating to human rights violations. They had been monitoring, and they had information, and they didn't do anything about it. So here you have British Petroleum saying, we're voluntarily going to collect that kind of information because we'd rather know about it and do something about it than know about it, not do something about it, and be associated with it. I think these are concrete examples of what, again, I would say is a new diplomacy. It's that you're beginning to see put into practice an awareness of human rights or an awareness of a principle, let's say, embodied in the Human Rights Convention. Let's say child labor, wiping out child labor in certain agricultural uses. You're beginning to see people trying to figure out a way to put into practice, even where we don't have yet a consensus on an issue, to put into practice a remedial structure designed to address a specific problem, not waiting for state consensus. But imagine, if you will, if you have it first in cocoa and then expand it to other markets, you can see that over time, probably a faster time than you would ever get state consensus in the normal way, you could see over the course of, say, a decade, beginning to form a norm when large groups of MNCs would just not purchase goods under certain circumstances relating to a norm of human rights. And that's what I think makes it so interesting when we look at this. The idea that lenders would say, I will sacrifice profit and fees if certain standards of international law are not met is a very interesting concept. I mean, these are public companies. They have an obligation to make profit. And yet they're saying, we're willing to forego certain opportunities if certain standards aren't met, and we're willing to actually self-report. We're willing to be the conduits of collecting data. This is a very interesting development. It's a fascinating development. And I think it's something that we're going to see other areas of potential application. And let me give you some examples just to close. I think industrial safety is an area of tremendous potential application. Think about mine safety. Right? Think about China. Right? Mine safety is now a hot issue, in part because of what's happened in the U.S. in the last month. But mine safety is a big issue around the world now. And if you look at certain industries, you could find the market share where you might actually see something similar to the Cocoa Accords in, say, the mining industry. I wonder about toxic waste handling, certain kinds of toxic waste, where, again, there are only a few companies who do it in certain industries. Nuclear waste comes to mind immediately. UNCLOS, using the UN Law of the Sea Convention, I wonder if fishing, overfishing especially, the monitoring and defeat of overfishing in certain areas of the world, query whether that is an area where which could be susceptible to this approach, where rather than relying on states to fall into line, the more likely answer is for NGOs to focus on multinationals as a way of creating conduct that we want to encourage. Corporate codes of conduct. Whether we will see people like the OECD or the EU realize that if they cause corporations to put in place certain codes of conduct, they may more quickly see the development of norms that they want to foster. Again, tying things into lending, project payments, arbitration clauses forcing states to go into arbitral tribunals and litigate issues like human rights violations. It's not so far-fetched when you think about lenders doing it in project finance deals. Another possibility that I think is very interesting is the training of judges in developing economies. I think it would not surprise me to see, and in fact I know of a group that's attempting to do this in the Palestinian Authority territories, it would not surprise me to see NGOs and multinationals figuring out ways to come up with money to finance the development of local court systems on the theory that local court systems help economic development, that in the long term, the creation of rule of law in a society, the perpetuation of commercial codes, knowing that there's a court system that can actually enforce them, is one way to foster economic development, which in the long run is good for companies, is something that I don't think is far-fetched, is something that is actively being discussed in certain communities. I would think women's and children's rights issues, is an, like the Cocoa Accords, is an area we could see susceptible to this. Certain kinds of public health emergencies, I mean, you wonder whether Doctors Without Frontiers and certain multinationals couldn't do well working together to get access to places where they otherwise can't get access by themselves. I think the other two things that are very interesting about this from a poli-sci sort of standpoint, one is I think there's an opportunity here for NGO to NGO alliances. And I think we're going to start seeing that. I think we're going to start seeing NGOs realize that they can leverage themselves. If they have enough money and if they're well organized enough or if they've got the right issue at the right moment, I think NGO alliances could become a new thing, could become a much more focused area of interest. The other thing that I think is we could see, imagine governments not the United States. In fact, imagine governments resentful of, let's say, U.S. influence in certain areas. Query whether we might start seeing some of those governments engage with NGOs in policy areas where they can't get any traction going state to state. And again, I mean, a concrete example, the Kimberley Accords, the Diamond Accords, the NGO chosen as the monitor, one of the two NGOs chosen was a Canadian NGO that monitors certain human rights issues in Africa, and I think they were specifically picked because not U.S., not French, not Russia. They wanted someone perceived as being more non-aligned. And so it wouldn't surprise me to see governments who feel frozen out begin to look for ways to ally themselves with NGOs to start attacking certain kinds of issues. But what I think is so interesting about this is I really do think this is real, and I think it is a developing trend. I think there are too many examples of it to just toss it off as something that isn't a trend. And I think that it's being fed by the amount of convergence we are seeing in terms of certain key rules of law that regulate MNCs. I think MNCs are realizing now that they can't blithely ignore these principles. It's sort of catching up with them. And I think that what they are doing pragmatically is saying, okay, I'm going to pick the ways I engage. And it might be actually more productive to engage with the NGOs who attack me. Maybe it would be better to engage with the NGOs and come up with a system in which I feel I can live and can do business than wait for governments to figure out a way to regulate me in ways I might not like. But I know what we're seeing, certainly in our firm, is that these kind of dialogues are increasing. And the Equator Principles are already having a huge effect on project finance transactions. Just enormous, much more than anyone thought they would. Definitely sort of the law of unintended consequences, the way it's sort of rippling out. And it just makes me think that there is a new diplomacy going on here. And at some level, states are going to have to start paying attention to it and figuring out what role they want to play in regulating it. So those are my thoughts for today.